Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. At the beginning of June, Mexico completed an extraordinary presidential election, choosing the country's first female president, who won with a record number of votes and by a record margin of victory. But the election was extraordinary in another way. The scale of violence, which included more than 100 political assassinations, as well as kidnappings, forced disappearances, attempted murders, and attacks on family members and campaign staff. Even worse, similarly extraordinary levels of violence are occurring in Chile, Peru, Ecuador, Central America, other parts of South America. Although the specific causes differ, what all of this has in common are the surging strength and brutality of the drug cartels. Can the cartels be stopped? Why are they increasingly trying to control electoral processes? Should we be worrying about the emergence of narco cities, states, and even countries in Latin America? My guest today is an expert on cartel and gang violence in the Americas and elsewhere. Journalist Chris Dalby is the founder of World of Crime, a think tank investigating organized crime. He recently published CJNG, and you'll find out what that means in a bit, A Quick Guide to Mexico's Deadliest Cartel, which is the first in a series of guides to the most dangerous organized crime groups in the world. Welcome, Chris, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you, Alan. It's an absolute privilege to be here.
Let's start with the Mexican elections. Politics in Mexico has long been a blood sport, but what seems to be happening is that the cartels have shifted perhaps their ambitions. I have the impression that most of the violence is local, aimed at local control, local mayors, local politicians, and that mirrors their geography. But could it be more than that? Is it just about controlling the street corner, or is it about beginning to move towards seizing political power in some ways?
We are long past just controlling the street corner. As you mentioned, drug trafficking, criminal violence, and politics in Mexico have been intricately linked for decades. But indeed, in the last, I would say, two or three electoral cycles, we have seen a gradual shift in what cartels are looking to get out of these elections. Elections are a way for cartels to throw the status quo in doubt, increase their criminal governance, either cement their control of existing politicians or put new contenders under their boot. But we have to move away from a fairly damaging concept, one which is very seductive, but damaging. The ways that cartels interact with politics in Mexico is not a single block. Different cartels have very clear and very different modus operandi in the way they interact with politics. For the sake of this call, I'll focus on two, the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco cartel New Generation, or the CJNG, by far the two biggest and most powerful groups in Mexico. The Sinaloa cartel has been around for decades in various forms, even long before El Chapo. And from its base in Sinaloa and extending into neighboring states, it has always sought to do business. It would absolutely project force and kill who it needed to, including judges and police commanders and politicians and mayors and governors, if it needed to. But its ideal scenario was to find a balance, was to find a way to do business, pay people off to look the other way, involve them if they could be involved, but do business.
In that sense, what you're saying there, violence was a means to an end. The end was economics.
I would say violence is always a means to an end, but how often you deploy it and the message that that sends does vary quite widely. Even today, with the new incarnation of the Sinaloa cartel, the Chapitos, the sons of Chapo Guzman, who have certainly modernized the cartel, they have moved away from some of the morality, some of the no extortion rules that their father and his partners had put in place. They still don't deploy violence in the systematic way that the cartel Jalisco New Generation does. And you look at the map of electoral violence this time. States where the CJNG is dominant or close to being dominant saw far higher rates of political violence than states where the Sinaloa cartel is dominant or close to dominant. Why is that? The CJNG is responsible for committing or having suffered over 80% of cartel-related killings in the last decade in Mexico. One group, for all the myriad of criminal groups in Mexico, one group, over 80% of cartel-related deaths, either it committed or suffered.
Order of magnitude, 80% of what is the number? 80% of what?
80% of, I'm not going to put a number to it because it's extremely difficult to quantify, but 80% of cartel-on-cartel violence. So I'm not talking about every homicide in Mexico, but 80% of killings that have been directly attributed to the cartel, that number comes from the Uppsala Conflict Data Program in Scandinavia. I use that statistic because it really shows the way in which violence is bred into the CJNG. And a lot of that comes from its origins. This is a group that was bred from conflict. This was a group that came out of the wars in Michoacán that was then spun off from the Sinaloa cartel's wars with the Beltran Labor Organization that got into it with the Zetas in the early 2000s, then again in 2011. This is a group where their expansion was through violence, not commerce. The Sinaloa cartel grew from gradually working its way up the drug trafficking supply chain. And while the CJNG did that as well, it did that in a far bloodier, more systematic violence. It would almost arrive into a new territory or a new part of Mexico, as it did in Guanajuato, as it did in Zacatecas, as it did in Veracruz, with an invasion. Narcomantas would go up in a bunch of municipalities, telling local criminal groups to get in line, threatening local politicians with death if they didn't comply, and then actively following up on those threats. If you look at the way that the CJNG deploys political violence today, it does that even in areas where you would think it doesn't need to, even in Jalisco, even in Colima, even in northern Michoacán, areas which have been under its boot for many years. So that tells us that every single electoral cycle, instead of seeking to maintain the status quo, it puts it into jeopardy. Whether that is a top-down command from El Mencho, or whether that is due to the power and the faith that is put into individual plaza bosses, I don't know. But there certainly is the enough data to say that there is encouragement from high leaders in the CJNG to reuse and reuse and reuse political violence in the same municipalities, to never accept that power has been achieved to a sufficient degree, and to always seek to extort and rob and access what they can of state budgets more and more and more.
Two very different questions. First is geography. Reportedly, 5 of Mexico's 31 states accounted for half of all the violence.
Yep.
And those are the places that you've just mentioned. The United States government considers those states as very dangerous, almost no-go states. And they're the epicenters of several of the cartels. Two very different questions. One, are those already failed states in any definition of failed states? That is to say, the government doesn't really control them. The cartels control them. And two, is it only those 5 or 6 places out of the 31 states? And is the risk that it, like a cancer, it grows?
I think the concept of a failed state is a difficult one. There are certainly parts of Jalisco, Colima, certainly Michoacán, that are no-go areas where any entry, and as has been proven by entrances by the Mexican army and Mexican police and the high levels of deaths that they face, would be met with severe violence. At the same time, the state of Colima, which is consistently one of the most violent in Mexico, has the country's largest seaport. At the same time, Jalisco, which gave the CJNG its name, has the tourist resort of Puerto Vallarta, to which many, many Americans and Canadians and more go on holiday every year. And we know that many CJNG leaders live in and around Puerto Vallarta. We know that that city is a hub for their money laundering activities, for their fronts, for their extortion. So it's not accurate to say that all the cartel activity in Mexico happens in no-go failed areas. It intersects with the economic, with the legal and licit economic lungs of the country, whether that be tourism, whether that be international trade, whether that be investment and infrastructure. It's impossible to divide cartel activities in Mexico from daily political and business life. Those things are too intertwined. To come to your second question as to whether it could grow, that again depends on what you mean and in what time frame. There are parts of Mexico that you could point at as today being fairly safe, safer in many ways than many parts of the USA. That could be Baja California Sur, that could be Tlaxcala, that could be Yucatan, which for several reasons currently evade cartel attention. They're not on major drug trafficking routes, they don't have major oil resources, they're not necessarily hubs for extortion. But at any time, that can shift. I point you to the state of Chiapas in the south of Mexico, which, while for years having been a Sinaloa cartel-controlled area on the border with Guatemala, which saw a lot of movement of drugs, of weapons, of migrants, was never a particularly violent state. I caveat that, of course, that is within the Mexican context. Within the last 2 years, and a little bit more now, with the Jalisco cartel moving in and contesting that space, it has suddenly rocketed to be one of the most violent places in Mexico. Tens of thousands of people, including in indigenous communities, have been displaced and or forcibly recruited. Migrants crossing that southern border are reporting levels of extortion and criminal abuse comparable with what they see on the northern border. That is a change that has happened in 2 years, but has completely switched the criminal demographic in a very important part of Mexico.
There's two obvious questions. One, what is the government doing about it or could be doing about it? And one, obviously, is where does this go over the next years? With regard to the first, what's government doing about it? The government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador famously said their policy was going to be hugs, not bullets, to focus on the underlying economic causes that allegedly are the source of this kind of criminal activity, which sounded like a good bumper sticker and bad policy, and has proven to be a bad bumper sticker and worse policy.
This is the only defense that I will make of López Obrador in this podcast, and it will be a very brief one, I assure you. I don't think hugs, not bullets was ever meant to be a real policy. I think it was just a quote that he said a couple of times. It was as you say, it was a bumper sticker. López Obrador understood fairly readily in his presidency that, remarkably, he didn't have to do anything about security to stay popular. The electoral base that he had gathered, the coalition of voters that had put him into power, was partly an electorate that was royally fed up with the duality of PRI and PAN, but also a worker base that he went out of his way to cater to. We are talking about, you know, raising the minimum wage, raising benefits, raising unemployment wages, really allowing these people in tough economic times to see material benefits from an AMLO presidency. Once that was established, once the dominance of state politics in Mexico was so thoroughly Morena, which was only confirmed in the recent election, he seemed to relegate security to something that was a bit too difficult to try and tackle. He would make, you know, ooh noises when bad things happen. But this is a president who went from saying he would support and protect and even fund the NGOs of mothers who search the mass graves to find the bodies of their relatives. In the first months of his presidency, he said he would support and protect and fund them. And in January, he called them necrophiles. In January, he intimated these mothers who simply want to find their children or their husbands were necrophiles. Consider the moral implications of that, right? It's just a statement. It's just a throwaway line. It's a horrible one. But that tells you something about the journey he went on over 5 years.
And tells you that from a political point of view, this is maybe more of an American issue. It's more of an elite issue. It is not an issue that seems to move not just the base, the majority of Mexican voters.
I think it would. I think it would absolutely move Mexican voters if, and I don't know what or how that would look like, But if there was a policy that seemed fresh, that seemed new, and didn't involve raising the body count dramatically, I don't know that that is possible. I don't know that that can happen. No one, certainly in recent Mexican elections, has had a policy like that. So I think it has become apathetic. There's a term in Brazil, which I like, which is rouba mais faz, which is they steal, but what are they going to do for it, right? We accept that they're going to steal, but what is the minimum amount that they can steal, and or what is the minimum amount that they can do for us while still stealing? I think AMLO is seen very much in that light.
Well, and to some extent, the cartels during COVID did exactly that. They provided food, they provided to local communities.
Right.
They did what other similar terrorist groups have done in other parts of the world. They became the local government when federal government was not, state governments were not terribly effective.
Of course. And that was a way of temporarily increasing their criminal governance through soft power. The way that criminals expand their governance is very much through hard power. But I wouldn't say that they're necessarily interested in taking over government in, let's say, I don't think that a Sinaloa cartel member or a CJNG cartel member is going to be governor or even president. At the moment, that's not how they operate. At the moment, how they operate is if you're the mayor of a town or the governor of a state, they're going to want to see, they've moved beyond just paying you to look the other way or not prosecute them or stay out of their way. They've moved on to, okay, what state assets can we use to improve our criminal knowledge and criminal modus operandi? So, for example, in Jalisco, or in Michoacán, the CJNG has access to state databases on how many heads of cattle each producer has, or what product each farmer is making, or how many trucks are leaving a specific factory. They know that. They have the economic and the data on that. They can then create very sophisticated extortion rackets to take a almost 50% of revenue in some industries, 50% of profits in some industries, and leave these industries clinging on while they take everything that they can and nobody can stop them. And that is involved in industries that are completely linked to the US. It's not just drugs. It's not just avocados, as we well know. It's cargo trucks. It's cattle. It's all sorts of fishery products. Extortion in Mexico now has become such a across-the-board earner where the CJNG, to a lesser extent, the Sinaloa cartel, are squeezing every peso they can out of areas they control.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Obviously, Mexico has a lot at risk, and it's very hard to not be worried about how does this evolve in the next sixennium, the next 6 years, the nature of the process. But let's flip it around. Is this a sort of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas meme, in the sense that, okay, Mexico's a mess. There's a funny balance. It still works. A lot of people, Mexico survives. But how worried should the Americans be that this creeps across the border?
For all the division and bitter rhetoric in the U.S. political system, U.S. institutions, U.S. police forces, U.S. economic systems are strong enough that there is no possibility in my mind that the level of political corruption and criminal violence that we see in Mexico would happen in the U.S. at the moment. I simply don't see that as a remote possibility. You're talking about the foundational blocks of Mexico are not the same as in the US. And the way in which those blocks have splintered is not going to happen to the US, even with all the political rhetoric and January 6th and whatever. That's not happening. So we do have to quantify what sort of a threat do cartels present to the US. Because the cartels are responsible, to a very large extent, for the opioid crisis. The cartels are responsible for manufacturing the goods that hundreds of thousands of Americans are taking and ending their lives with. Now, the average cartel chemist will tell you, well, we're not forcing fentanyl or meth down the throats of any Americans, right? We're just providing a product. And that is the way they justify it, and that is the way they sleep at night. And indeed, there are several steps on the chain between a cartel cook in Michoacán and a meth user in San Francisco. Cartels are the wholesalers. Cartels bring product on bulk across the border. They store it, usually in large cities, but increasingly in smaller cities as well. And then they have their own relationships. They have their brokers. They have their drug dealers in, so the Dominican gangs, for example, in New York and on the East Coast, the Mexican mafia in California, who will buy those drugs. And they're the ones who are going to be splitting it up, selling it on street corners, or selling it directly to those who do, to the smaller traffic. So when people say, you know, the Mexican cartels are coming to your door, the Mexican cartels are you know, feeding drugs to your children, yes, but they're several steps removed from that act. The problem is that even in statements from law enforcement or police or courts, those relationships are not clear. You'll often see, you know, reports saying 27 CJNG members arrested. And then you read the press statement or you dig into the journalistic investigation, and it's actually, no, it's actually American citizens who were drug dealers in one particular city, but who probably bought drugs from the cartels. But of course, that doesn't sound good in a headline. That doesn't help you to justify a budget. That doesn't give you access to resources that have been unblocked to fight Mexican cartels. So it's useful often to blur those lines, but it can be damaging.
Push further. We're going to have an election in the United States this year. The border issues from a migration point of view are very much in the air. The drug issues are almost not at all in the air. Nor is violence in the sense that we've been talking about it. But we'll have a new administration in Mexico. We'll have a new administration in Washington, presumably. One way or the other, there will be renewed people, et cetera. Are there things, if you were advising the incoming president, whomever it is, on the U.S. side, that they ought to be doing either unilaterally or bilaterally to manage this issue better?
In Claudia Sheinbaum, while she is the chosen successor of López Obrador, I think the U.S. will have a much more receptive and willing partner. While there are credible fears that she will not do much on security or that López Obrador will be a major influence on her policy, if you look at the makeup of her advisors, her security advisors, there is some hope there. There was a report recently, I believe, in the Wall Street Journal, that said that during her time as mayor of Mexico City, Claudia Sheinbaum was taking advice from the DEA, looking at American cities that had high levels of criminal violence and drug use, and trying to adopt those measures in Mexico City. I believe the city of Oakland in California was a particular inspiration to her. I would advise American lawmakers to be in close touch with Omar Garcia Harfuch, who is one of Claudia Sheinbaum's closest advisors. He was formerly her security secretary in Mexico City. He was almost brutally assassinated in broad daylight in the capital by the CJNG because he had been arresting a lot of their leaders in the capital. He didn't win this electoral race. He was going to be mayor of Mexico City, but he didn't win that race. He's now in her close team. I don't know if she's going to appoint him to a formal cabinet position, but she should. I believe that those two together, if you look at the history of their engagements, the history of their respect for the DEA and for American influence in Mexico, they would be the top, the foremost collaborators, I think, with America. And America badly needs to restore its reputation in Mexico. While there might be individual operations that the DEA is carrying out or that others are carrying out, there is a belief, a lack of faith that America is willing or able to help. And the Biden administration's recent moves on migration have not done much to assuage that.
Well, and indeed, as I said a moment ago, this administration, but to an extent its predecessor as well, has downplayed these issues. Migration is a different question, and they've separated the two, which at one level are inseparable, but they have separated the two. Let's stay in Mexico for a minute, though. One of the proposals AMLO made and Claudia Sheinbaum has endorsed is to turn all of the judges into elected rather than appointed positions. Given how difficult it is to survive if you're a mayoral candidate in an electoral process, doesn't that just potentially open up yet another part of the government to the cartel's influence in about the worst possible way one could imagine, which is not to say that some of them aren't already influenced. I'm not arguing that all these judges are honest women and men, but rather, aren't you politicizing it in a dangerous moment? Or am I missing something?
100%. No, you are bang on the money with that. I believe the rationale, one of the rationales when that move was announced was in response to criticism that López Obrador had been filling key judicial positions with judges that were going to be favorable to his administration. So I think that was a way of moving past that. But given the fact that Morena controls the overwhelming majority of governorships, given the record margin with which Sheinbaum was elected, I think López Obrador can see that at least for the next one or two electoral cycles, the likelihood that voters are going to pick judges who seem to be aligned or who seem to be friendly to Morena's interests is quite high. So it was a gamble that he doesn't necessarily lose much much political capital on. In terms of what that's going to do for the judges, we don't have the data so far to say. Judges are not that commonly targeted in Mexico. It, of course, has and will happen. Right now, in recent years, it hasn't happened that frequently. It has more been prosecutors, it has more been police commanders, it has been more local police forces. Because going back to a point you made earlier, the control is hyper-local. Of course, if you can get a García Luna or a minister at that level to help you, wonderful. But the main interest in cartel criminal governance is local, at the municipal or perhaps at the state level. And judges are not necessarily going to be looking at cases at that level. It's going to be more towards the higher echelons in the federal cases where they can really hurt the cartels. So where that balance of power is going to shift, we don't know. But for sure, it puts judges in the firing line.
In the few minutes we have left, we can't really talk about the rest of Central and South America, but I have the impression that in country after country after country, we have different but similar evolution of increasingly, I hate the term organized crime or organized violence, but whether they're cartels or gangs, the level of activity, the level of violence, the level of penetration of political institutions seems to be rising in too many places. Is that a fair 60,000-foot observation?
I think it's counterproductive to fall into the trap of saying violence is rising across Latin America. It is in some countries. Obviously, Ecuador has been the just gone from a relatively stable haven of peace, again, compared to other parts of Latin America, to suddenly among the deadliest countries in the world in 5 years. There is a risk of that happening in many other countries, although they don't have the deep involvement in cocaine trafficking that Ecuador does, which was the cause of this rise in violence. But in Peru, certainly you could imagine that happening.
Even in Chile, you are beginning to see more, again, air quotes, organized crime activity or gang activity, allegedly Venezuelan, but I don't know if that's the case.
Chile is seeing an increase in violence. There has been an increase in Venezuelan crime with the Tren de Aragua in particular, which is actually the second book that we're going to publish on, the guide for the World of Crime guide to the Tren de Aragua is coming out in October. Because there's also rumors of that gang moving into the US. Chilean institutions are very strong. Chilean judicial and regulatory and supervisory institutions are very strong. And the way in which the use of force is used by police is very tightly monitored. I spoke with experts in Chile a month ago, who 2 years ago were telling us the house is on fire. The Venezuelans are moving in, the Dominicans are moving in, the Haitians are moving in, we can't control this, Chilean gangs are becoming stronger, this is a problem. Now, they're a little bit more relaxed, definitely saying there's more violence, definitely saying this is a concern. We're not sure we can put the genie back in the bottle. But for example, Tren de Aragua operations have been quite frequently dismantled. There are trials, public trials, at which information on these gangs is being revealed and being put into the hands of regional and district police commanders with a top-down command structure, with a top-down organizational structure to control and put forward a measured response. I see Chile as the opposite of El Salvador. El Salvador responded to gang violence by locking up over 2% of the adult population in beastly incarceration circumstances. So, of course, that country can say we have drastically reduced violent crime, and that is to be sure, and that is to their credit. But the cost of that in El Salvador is that you've destroyed freedom of expression, you've destroyed freedom of assembly, and you've destroyed freedom of the press. And what does that do to your country in 20 to 30 years? In Chile, so far, I've been quite impressed with the way that they've managed to keep their reputation as a beacon of democracy while also tackling gang violence quite head on.
Let me end with a somewhat personal question. You and your colleagues are trying to understand and discuss in public a scary world. Your guide, the CJNG guide, is fascinating reading, but I could imagine that some people who are described in it aren't happy that I'm able to read it. I can imagine that some of what you report regularly through your various outlets is uncomfortable. How do you do the voodoo you do?
Well, I thank you for the concern, Alan. That's very touching. The work that I do is an order of magnitude, several orders of magnitude, less dangerous than, and I'm not saying this to be quotable, to the heroes that do local journalism in Mexico, to the journalists that put their lives on the line day in and day out to report on what's happening locally in Mexico. Nothing of what I've reported, almost nothing of what I've reported, was not in some sense out there already. I'm connecting dots. I'm telling narratives that have already been published in different formats. Because the purpose of the guides that World of Crime writes is to answer a question that I've heard from law enforcement and prosecutors and lawmakers, which is, where do we start? There's so much out there. I worked for Insight Crime for 5 years, which is an absolutely wonderful institution and gives a crash course to anybody in how organized crime works in Latin America. But even with them, and even with all the reports that are done and the cases and the lawsuits, the point of the guides was to provide an actionable operational guide on the inner workings of the CJNG. And future guides will continue that trend. So the work that I do is built on what other journalists have done at the risk of their lives. And that is something that I think about every single day. I also left Mexico for those reasons. I now live in the Netherlands in Europe. I travel to Latin America, of course, very regularly. But I have, of course, put some distance between myself and the people I'm reporting on.
Let's leave it there. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you for the work you're doing. And I would underline your comments about Mexican journalists, which has got to be one of the scarier occupations, at least for the good ones. And we both have mutual friends who are no longer with us because they did their job.
I appreciate that, Alan. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.